Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, immigration reform may be stalled in Washington, but a slate of new laws signed by Governor Jerry Brown have injected the Golden State into the immigration debate in a bold new way. We'll talk about what these changes mean for the Valley in a few minutes. We'll also learn about what the leaders of Visalia's College of the Sequoias are doing to get the college back on track. After its future was threatened earlier this year, COS President Stan Carrizosa will join us. We'll also talk with a caravan of artists and scholars who are retracing the route of the Jode family from Oklahoma to Kern County to celebrate the 75th anniversary of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and learn about some events coming up to celebrate the occasion in Bakersfield and Arvin. That, and we'll talk to one business that's actually thriving due to the government shutdown, coming up right after the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. The passage of some high-profile immigration legislation in California appears to signal a shift in the state's attitude on the issue, particularly with its governor, Jerry Brown. Max Pringle reports from Sacramento.
In 2010, then-candidate Brown opposed driver licenses for undocumented immigrants. This month, he signed a bill allowing licenses for undocumented immigrants. Brown says the law now reflects the outlook of the majority of Californians.
The people of California, a strong majority, are sympathetic to the plight of those who have come to California to live and work.
Dan Schnurr with the Jesse Unruh Institute of Politics at USC agrees. He says Proposition 87, which barred undocumented immigrants from public services, passed by a 2-to-1 margin in 1994. Now he says it wouldn't stand a chance.
As is the case on many other cultural and social issues, younger voters really do drive a change in public opinion in a very significant way.
Governor Brown recently signed a domestic worker bill of rights, and just this past weekend he signed the Trust Act, which would prevent local police from holding people arrested for minor offenses for federal immigration authorities. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
California Governor Jerry Brown has vetoed a bill that would have allowed non-citizens who are in the state legally to serve on juries. Ben Adler says Monday's veto appears to show there are limits to the rights Brown is willing to grant legal immigrants.
Earlier this year, the governor did sign a bill to allow lawful permanent residents who are not citizens to be poll workers. But in his veto message on the jury service bill, he says that jury service, like voting, is quintessentially a prerogative and responsibility of citizenship. And he goes on to say in his veto message of the bill that would allow lawful permanent residents who are not citizens to serve on a jury, quote, I don't think that's right.
Meanwhile, Brown has signed a measure that will change California's electricity rate structure. It will take some of the pressure off the highest energy users in the hottest parts of the state and charge all users a flat fee of up to $10. A Tulare County Sheriff's deputy was arrested Monday after reports of sexually assaulting a woman last week. She alleges the deputy approached her and asked her for her license. When the woman said she didn't have one, the officer said he would let her go in exchange for sexual contact. The woman declined, but she said he took advantage of her. The deputy is now on administrative leave and was booked in the Kings County Jail. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill Monday that would have allotted $5 million a year to fight the Asian citrus psyllid through the state's Department of Food and Agriculture. The pest has now been found throughout the Central Valley and can spread a disease that could devastate the citrus industry. In his veto message, Brown said that while he shares concerns about the disease, the funding issue should be revisited during the budget process. Plans for a new minor league baseball stadium in Bakersfield have fallen through. The owners of the Bakersfield Blaze released a statement Monday saying that despite significant efforts to raise money for the stadium, fundraising has substantially fallen short. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It may seem like just yesterday, but 10 years ago this week, Arnold Schwarzenegger unseated Gray Davis in a unique election in California history. As Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, the debate over Schwarzenegger's legacy and the recall itself persists to this day.
I want to be the people's governor. I will work honestly, without fear or favor, to do what is right for all Californians.
Join Arnold and let's bring California back.
Arnold Schwarzenegger built his 2003 recall campaign on a platform to cut spending and shrink the bloated state bureaucracy. Nearly 3 years after he left office, he's probably best remembered for California's years of brutal budget deficits and his landmark global warming law. But USC political analyst and former Republican consultant Dan Schnur believes Schwarzenegger's legacy lies in the changes he brought to the state's political process.
He didn't blow up boxes. There weren't explosions inside or around the state capitol. But the less glamorous work of passing reforms like redistricting and top two primary have the potential to have just as dramatic, if not a more dramatic, impact on state government.
Sacramento State's Steve Boilard, on the other hand, argues that Schwarzenegger's failure to achieve many of his policy goals showed voters that California's problems couldn't be fixed by one person, no matter how big his personality. It was the system that needed to change, and that, he says, is what led to the political reforms.
In my mind, it wasn't so much that Arnold Schwarzenegger created all that by his own will. It's rather he brought about a situation where people kind of had to go there because they realized that the silver bullet was not in just picking the right politician.
Both analysts hope the changes will reduce partisanship at the Capitol and make California easier to govern, but they say it's too soon to know. At the state Capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Joining us now to talk more about California's past governor's legacy and also our current governor and some of the things that are happening right now in Sacramento, we have one of our regular guests, political scientist Thomas Holyoke. He's a professor at Fresno State. Tom, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
The legacy of Governor Schwarzenegger versus the legacy of the recall. How do you weigh those two? How do you separate those two?
Well, the legacy of the recall is probably more long-lasting simply because of the drama of what happened. I mean, actually using the ballot to recall a sitting governor. I mean, this something like that would never really been contemplated before. And while I don't think anyone's really contemplating trying to remove the current governor, the fact that it happened once means it always could, and this is something that governors need to keep an eye on, not just in California but in other states that have the same ability to do this sort of thing. So that was a pretty big dramatic event.
Well, California voters have proven the ability to surprise people at times with decisions at the ballot box. But just last week, we saw the launch of the state's health insurance exchange covered California. That was something that Governor Schwarzenegger trumpeted and signed into law, as well as other things like the state's landmark anti-global warming bill, SB 365 and AB 32, those issues also. Is it going to be some time yet before we really can assess Governor Schwarzenegger's legacy, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the big projects that he set in motion, and we're sort of waiting to see if they're going to pan out. He was, as I recall, largely a supporter of things like high-speed rail. He was a big supporter of trying to revamp the state's water system and trying to get a handle on the state's water politics, which is probably the single nastiest issue in the state. And he's the one who actually with some success, got a lot of different warring parties over water to sit down and put together a big, you know, commission task force to try to bring more reliable water resources to farmers, at the same time trying to restore the ecological health of the Delta. We don't know how that's going to pan out. Jerry Brown seems to have embraced it as well, but it started with Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, and well, yet to be seen what the fate of the water bond is moving forward. Now turning to more current issues and that of immigration reform. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown traveled to Fresno to sign a bill that would allow undocumented immigrants to obtain California driver's licenses. Then on Saturday, Brown signed 8 other bills dealing with immigration, ranging from allowing undocumented immigrants to become lawyers to prohibitions on workplace retaliation against employees who were in the country illegally. The governor also signed the Trust Act, which will prohibit law enforcement from detaining individuals on the basis of their immigration status before they become eligible for release from custody. The governor is interjecting himself with this slate of bills on immigration into a national debate, is he not?
Yes. Sacramento political columnist Dan Walters had, I thought, another interesting take on this, in that what's happening here in California is that the state is filling the void left by the federal government and the federal government's refusal or inability to act on immigration reform. Immigration reform is fundamentally a federal government issue, but the federal government is paralyzed. And so in that void, Jerry Brown in California is trying to do something. And so are other states, although some states like Arizona are trying to do it in the opposite direction, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, we actually have a clip from Governor Brown's speech last Thursday at Fresno City College now where he talks about this very issue.
The very fact that 1 million people who are undocumented are now recognized by the law of California, that sends a message to Congress. When they come back and get back to work, if they ever do, they're not going to be able to ignore 1 million people who are recognized by the state of California. We are the biggest state, we are the dream state, and now we're the state of opportunity, and we're sending a message to Washington, wake up, wake up.
Now, the politics of this is kind of interesting because Brown, when he campaigned for governor, was not in favor of the driver license issue. You also have folks like Jerry Dyer, Fresno police chief, who are out in favor of this issue, whereas his boss, Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearengin, was noticeably absent from the discussion. But Swearengin, a loyal Republican on most issues, I imagine it's not a surprise that she wasn't on the stage at Fresno City College last Thursday.
Well, Governor Brown, in terms of his policy positions, is always something of a moving target. In fact, many of his detractors say that he sort of just changes with the wind. He's whatever he needs to be that particular week. So it wasn't any particularly great surprise. And to a large extent, what he's doing, I think, is simply practical. You know, there's an awful lot of people in California undocumented and are therefore driving without, you know, regular driver's licenses
and insurance.
And that's right. And simply, you know, you're dealing with, you know, what do you do when one of them is in an accident? And just trying to cope with that and bring some, you know, sanity to the process is what I think led the governor to sign the bill and for Chief Dyer to support it.
How do you think this plays any role into the national debate, whether Congress takes immigration reform back up when they have other things off their plate?
Is that ever going to happen? Well, yes. I mean, part of what's going on in California and in some of the other states is not just filling the void, but also, you know, basically telling Washington, if you are not going to act, then we're going to act. And, you know, conservatives in Washington, D.C., who probably are not overly thrilled with the direction California is going, may feel that they then do need to step up and try to get some kind of immigration legislation through, which may have different kinds of priorities and different kinds of restrictions and possibly preempt California law. They can do that on immigration policy. And this might move them into action, but frankly, I don't think so.
Well, speaking of restoring sanity to things, let's talk about Washington and the government shutdown. One Valley congressman continues to play a very high-profile role in the controversy. He seems to be enjoying the spotlight, and that's Devin Nunes, who last week called his fellow Republicans lemmings with suicide vests, talking about the faction in the party that is pushing to continue the effort to shut down the government over the effort to halt Obamacare. This week, he's still in the news, and he's basically accused his colleague in the Senate, Colorado Senator Ted Cruz, of lying to House Republicans. He said, it's really difficult at this time until Cruz tells the people to decide to admit to our base that the whole premise of getting rid of Obamacare by shutting down the government was a lie. He said this is his strategy that he's laid out, spent his money on, and he's got a lot of members of the Congress to go along with. Nunes seems to be enjoying this role that others in his party aren't being quite so vocal. Is it because he has a safe seat and he doesn't have to worry about being outflanked from his right or the left?
You know, I did kind of a mental double take when I started when I first heard Congressman Nunes talking about that. You know, Congressman Nunes is generally through most of his career has been a pretty loyal member of the House GOP and not a person one would say is not particularly conservative. He's always been, you know, very conservative. For him to suddenly speak against the most conservative side of his party and to some extent defy the speaker, John Boehner, is really a good view of just how problematic things are in the House of Representatives right now, and with the enormous rift that seems to have opened up amongst House Republicans in Washington. I mean, it was really quite incredible, especially his taking to task of Senator Cruz of Texas, oppose one of the great rising stars of the Republican Party, basically saying that Senator Cruz drug House Republicans, I think it was, drug them into traffic and then left them there without any kind of game plan on how to get out of the situation.
Getting out of the situation is something that a lot of political pundits on both sides of the aisle are looking for. What's the solution to this? There was one unnamed member of the House that talked to Byron York, the political columnist with the Washington Examiner, and compared this situation to the Battle of Gettysburg and saying that both parties stumbled into this, not expecting this fight to actually happen. But now that it's happening, they're throwing more resources and more bodies into the fight without a clear idea of what the possible outcome can be. Is there a way that Republicans can save face in backing down? Is there a way that Democrats offer up some concession, or does the president continue to stand firm?
Thinking about the Gettysburg analogy, if that's true, then I suppose Senator Cruz's opposition is Pickett's charge, the great ill-fated charge up a hill in the face of cannons where the entire Confederate company was wiped out. I think we are starting to see some important shifts going on. All of a sudden, Speaker John Boehner and a lot of the other Republican leadership are suddenly not talking about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, so much anymore. And that, I think, is an important rhetorical shift. They're talking again about overall government spending levels and changes that might need to be made there and to the current tax law as negotiating over this as a requirement for funding the government and, more importantly, raising the government's debt ceiling. So I think they've really started to come to grips with the idea that they are not going to get any real concessions out of the president regarding Obamacare. It's not clear they're going to get any concessions out of the president over much of anything. The president and the Senate leader, Harry Reid of Nevada, have both absolutely refused to negotiate as long as the House Republicans continue to deny funding the government and are threatening to default on the nation's debt. But if some kind of agreement can potentially be struck over government funding, which might lead to further reductions in government funding, and if agreements can be reached on some changes to the tax law, both Republicans and Democrats want changes to the tax law made, although Republicans mostly in terms of reducing money coming into the government, and Democrats wanting a simplified tax code to actually increase revenues. If they can somehow reconcile that, then maybe we'll back to this grand bargain that everyone was talking about in 2011 as a way to resolve this really, really naughty issue. But on the other hand, they tried to reach for the grand bargain in 2011, and the president and Speaker Boehner just could not get the deal done, and it all fell apart very publicly, very dramatically, and with a lot of bitterness.
There's a lot of people talking about the state, the stasis in Washington right now, and Ezra Klein had a very interesting piece in the Washington Post Wonk blog yesterday talking about the gridlock in D.C., and he cited about 11 different things, but the very first one I thought was very interesting, and he cited the elimination of earmarks as a bad thing in terms of the horse trading that in the past has gone on when it comes to getting a big piece of legislation through. Do you see that as being something that, again, a few years ago, the House outlawed earmarks and this was touted as a political reform? There's been all sorts of evidence of Bridges to Nowhere and other pet projects of various members of Congress that get through under the earmark law. But what about its role in terms of the bargaining that makes Washington in some times sort of work?
That I agree with Ezra on that. And it's one of several changes that have happened since the 1990s that have essentially made it very hard to cut deals in Washington, D.C. In the 1990s, a lot of they put cameras in the House and Senate chambers, and there was a lot more scrutiny of members of Congress by their own constituents, which by itself is a good thing. And members of Congress started spending more and more time back in their home district than in Washington. So they weren't getting to know each other in Washington, and people weren't becoming friends with each other. And even when that was happening, though, deals could still be cut because earmarks, what a lot of people think of as pork barreling, this ability to get federal money for individual projects in a member of Congress's home district or state, that still kind of made the machinery work, because if a particular member of Congress was opposed to a particular policy or doing something like raising the debt limit or just wanted the appearance of that, they were usually able to extract concessions out of the congressional leadership in return for their vote. And the concessions would be earmarked funding for particular projects. It could be for a whole variety of projects. It could be for a drug treatment center. It could have been for improving an emergency room. It could have been for improving a dam to provide more water for irrigation. But it was that sort of activity was portrayed as contributing to the national debt. And it was kind of an easy target because there were some really bizarre projects going on, including former Senator Ted Stevens' famous bridge to nowhere in Alaska, a gigantic bridge off the Alaskan mainland to an island with only a small number of people living on it. And so as a sign of fiscal discipline in Washington, House Republicans in the Senate too, but really in the House of Representatives, essentially banned earmarks. And we were talking earlier about Congressman Nunes. He was a big proponent of banning earmarks. He just wasn't going to do it himself and pressured other people into not doing it. And they passed some changes in the rules of the appropriations process in the House to make it nearly impossible, not entirely, but nearly impossible.
Well, it's very interesting, and we'll see how this plays out. And this just in, President Obama will be holding a press conference later this morning at 11 a.m. Stay tuned to Valley Public Radio. We'll offer live coverage of that event coming up during Here and Now, hosted by NPR News. And then again, also at 10 o'clock, we have a special program note. We have a special documentary about the dropout crisis in California's Central Valley. It's called Class Dismissed, and that's coming up at 10. So stay with us here on Valley Public Radio. We've been talking about the shutdown in Washington and politics in general with Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joe.
All right. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and find out the progress that the College of Sequoias is hoping to make in keeping its doors open and its accreditation crisis that's been underway throughout this year. Stan Carrizosa, the college's president, will join us on the phone in just a moment here on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This past February, Visalia's College of the Sequoias was faced with a threat to its very existence, loss of accreditation or potential loss of accreditation, and was given until mid-October to show that it had made corrections. The college received a show cause order, the highest level of penalty short of termination, from the Western Association of Schools and Colleges. Joining us now to tell us more about this process and the work that's been underway in the past 6 months is COS President Stan Carrizosa. Stan, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. You've had quite the first year on the job, Stan. You began service in July 2012. What has this process been like from February to today?
Oh, it's been really an interesting and exhausting process. A lot of hard work, but I will say that a team of college professionals that have banded together well to focus on the problem, work hard on the issues, kind of remain soft on the people, and I think because of that, we've made incredible progress.
Now, walk us through some of the history of this. This goes back to 2006, if not earlier.
And yeah, We actually had, you know, you get accredited in six-year cycles, and we had a formal accreditation in 2000, and then another accreditation cycle in 2006, and then again, most recently, 2012. If you roll the clock back, we did have in 2000 some recommendations to improve in specific areas of internal operations. I think one of the key points to make up front is that there was never a question from the accrediting body about the quality of our program, about the rigor of our academic outcomes, the success of our vocational skill certification programs. You know, we have an award-winning nursing program, an outstanding police academy. So if there's a silver lining under the dark cloud, it's that the outcomes, the outputs of our programs were never questioned. What was very fragile was the internal workings. And I think being a publicly funded institution, over time, when you can't show solid structures that your college is operating on, you know, you're a taxpayer-funded organization and people want to know that their tax dollars are going into institutions that have some structural integrity. So in 2000, we were called out a little bit for not having the right kind of decision-making processes in place that were solid and were consistent. They needed more clarity. We needed a better planning cycle that tied the college's long-term plan to short-term planning, so that we could have priorities for allocation of resources. And then in 2000, we were also beginning to make a shift as an institution across the state to more accountability in the actual courses that were offered themselves. And we were being asked to write student learning outcomes for every course that we taught at College of the Sequoias. And we started that process. And between 2000 and 2006, we made progress. But when they rolled back in 2006, they found that particularly in the areas of planning, decision-making, and student learning outcomes, we had not made enough progress, so they put us on an official warning. And that warning status required us to kind of kick ourselves into gear and to show a complete plan for how we were going to be fully compliant within the next six-year cycle. And the Accrediting Commission came in and checked on us in 2007, and they checked on us again in 2009, and actually lifted our warning sanction and said, hey, based on the midterm progress here, you've got a plan in place to get your student learning outcomes all written. You've developed a strategic plan that ties to your long-term master plan. We like that. Your decision-making processes seem to be working more effectively. So we're going to lift the warning off you all, and we're going to hope that when we come back in 2012, you've got this all tied up, all done, complete, and ready to go. And I think really what happened between that 2009 period and 2012 is we just didn't continue to make the progress that was expected. So when the ACCJC came back in 2012, they had to take a look at the longitudinal picture. They had to say, hey, wait a minute, this has been an issue for 10 years. It's been brought forward in two different accreditations now. We had a six-year period where this group was on warning, and so we really don't have too many options left. I mean, we can put you on probation, but it seems like that's what the last 6 years really has been. So I was a little, like you said, surprised as a new president to learn that this level of sanction was going to come on what, in our opinion, are not institution-closing kinds of issues. So even though our budget was in order, our outcomes were good, the long-term productivity of our college was showing success, the consistent inability for us to be compliant with those internal operations is what finally ended up in the show cause order.
We're talking with COS President Stan Carrizosa today. What has this done for the morale on campus, both with the student body and with the faculty? I was listening to a speech you gave in February when you announced this issue that when it first came out, and you indicated that there was some discussion on the campus and the faculty and others saying that, well, maybe this is unjust. Maybe they're being political in some way, or just some overall discord. Has this brought people closer together? What has it meant for the climate on campus?
Well, I think we've gone through, if you study any kind of normal social behaviors that occur in crisis situations like this, we've really fit the normal pattern. You know, there was a period of shock and awe. There was a period of denial that, you know, we've done much more work than they've given us credit for. There was a brief period of blame. You know, whose fault was this? What happened? Why didn't some things get done? And it was kind of the normal cycle of storming and renorming or the mourning process, you know. And I think what I'm really proud of about the faculty and the students and the staff at College of the Sequoias is we didn't dwell in that environment too long. We had our fair amount, you know, the first few weeks of everybody running a little bit frantic about what had happened. But we were able to pretty quickly assume a course of direction. We appointed, you know, the 40-member task force right away within 2 weeks of receiving the show cause notice. We handpicked individuals that we knew had potential for leadership and had a generally positive outlook on what was happening, weren't associated with any particular interest group other than what's good for the whole group. And once we incorporated a community advisory committee to be our source of community eyes and ears, and we set up an environment with 25 community advisory members who came in and met with us every 2 weeks. And they were not only our source of feedback and input from the broader community, but they served to monitor our work a little bit, to hold us accountable, mm-hmm. and then to become our advocates. They were well-informed. We had an avenue to make sure that rumors didn't spin out of control and good, accurate information fed out into the community every 2 weeks. And I think this process calmed everybody down. And from that point, we were able to really focus on the five major recommendations and the two minor, seven overall. We divided our group, our 40 members, up into small task forces, and each one of those subgroups went after one of those particular recommendation areas, enlisted broader swaths of mm-hmm. the campus. So we had, by the time we were done, we had hundreds of people engaged in a process to kind of reinvent ourselves. And I think while there were, you know, hurt feelings in the beginning, it immediately transitioned into kind of pulling together. And, you know, occasionally we've referred to the mission of Apollo 13 as kind of our metaphor. You know, we were all in the lunar module. We were all here at COS together. We were trying to get back to Earth. We had to build some new systems pretty quickly without a lot of time and plan to prepare. And so I think that kind of attitude has brought us closer. In the end, I really feel like we're going to be a much better organization than we were, and we're going to have stronger structures in place that are going to surely outlast any one president or any one academic Senate chairperson. We've built some systems to last, and I think that's good for the college.
We have this 1 minute left, Stan. October 15th is the big deadline that you're facing, turning in all of the information, your plan for moving forward. It's also the deadline that you have to turn in the, quote, college closure report. We certainly hope that doesn't happen. What's the next step, and how confident are you that you've corrected these issues and that the committee will be happy when it returns to visit?
Sure. We've got all of that work done. It's about a 300-page show cause report and another 20 pages or so of the closure report. That's being finalized now. All the I's dotted, all the T's crossed. We'll have that submitted on time. They'll have a team here to visit us in November. They're going to be doing the validation study to make sure that what we wrote in the report is what they actually see on the ground operating at COS. We're really confident that everything that we've done is genuine, strong, and will be verified. We're hoping that we get an extension of our show cause report. One of the things we want the community to know is you don't go from the edge of closure all the way back to fully affirmed accreditation in one fell swoop. Because so much of what we were trying to do was process-oriented, annual processes take a full year cycle to complete. And by the time they come to visit, we will not have had a full year. So we're expecting to get a really nice report that says you guys have done a wonderful job so far. You've got all the plans in place and your structures are operating. We'll be back at the end of the year mm-hmm. to make sure that you've closed the loop, and then we're going to fully affirm your 6-year accreditation.
Still more work to do. We wish you the best. COS President Stan Carrizosa joining us today on Valley Edition. Stan, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. When President Obama asked Congress to make its own decision on intervention in the Syrian crisis, it marked a break from other recent military actions, where the commander-in-chief didn't seek such approval from the legislative branch. And while the Syrian government is now pledging to abide by a UN resolution calling for the destruction of that country's chemical weapons stockpile, Fresno State Professor of Philosophy Andrew Fiala says the initial debate over military action was significant. In this edition of FM89's commentary series called The Moral Is, he reflects on the relationship between our democracy and our willingness to go to war.
It's a good thing that President Obama decided to ask Congress for approval to attack Syria. The ensuing public debate may have helped avoid another Middle Eastern war. Some worry that the president looked weak and that the U.S. lost credibility. But one of the central principles of the American system is the idea that Congress should supervise and authorize war-making activity. Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war. And the War Powers Resolution of 1973 requires congressional authorization for military engagements. Some may think that presidents should have unilateral power to go to war. War requires unified central power. In the era of intercontinental missiles and terrorism, threats are fluid, fast, and furious. The necessities of modern military power appear to require that the commander-in-chief be given the freedom to act without protracted congressional debate. Related to this is a practical concern about morale and unity of purpose. Congressional debate can be divisive, but war appears to require social solidarity, which can be undermined by public deliberation. Despite these concerns, public debate and congressional approval of war remain important ideas. Unlike in Egypt, where the army has overthrown a democratically elected government, Americans believe the military should obey the will of the people and defend the Constitution. Civilian control of the military is a central feature of mixed forms of government like our own. The concept of mixed government has deep roots that extend back to the ideas of the ancient Roman philosopher Cicero. It's appealing to imagine a benevolent central authority who protects the commonwealth, but benevolent dictators can become tyrannical, as happened in Rome. To prevent tyranny, Cicero advocated mixed government. This idea influenced the framers who created our system of checks and balances and the division of powers. In addition to preventing despotism, public debate about war can restrain militarism. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant, a contemporary of the American framers, argued that one of the keys to developing peace was to require popular approval of war. Kant thought that if people voted about war, there'd be fewer wars. It's easy for rulers to send other people's children to die in war and to spend other people's money on war, but it's harder to get we, the people, to agree to sacrifice our children and to contribute our tax dollars to the war effort. States stockpile horrible weapons. Armies turn against governments and open fire on their own people. In this context, the idea that military power ought to be limited by democratic control and the constitutional division of powers is a significant step in the right direction. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. National parks across the country may be off limits to visitors due to the government shutdown, but in the Sierra, it hasn't stopped efforts to recover from the Rim Fire. FM89's Ezra Romero reports.
Despite the shutdown of many federally funded programs and departments, a crew of around 50 fire response specialists are still on the job in the Stanislaus National Forest and in Yosemite National Park. Anna Payne is a spokeswoman for the Forest Service.
We have an emergency situation going on, so we have funding for emergency stabilization treatments. We are allowed to continue to work.
A few weeks ago, the team received $300,000 for safety measures, like repairing road signs and felling hazardous burnt trees devastated by the fire. Then on Monday, hours before the government shutdown, the Forest Service allocated another $4 million to help prevent flooding and erosion.
We have a couple of areas where there's sensitive habitat, and if we can help with the natural process of putting that woody debris on the ground to stabilize the soil. That's where the higher priorities where the treatments will be.
She also says anyone living in the fire area pay special attention to the weather as soon as it starts to rain this fall.
My crystal ball isn't working, but statistically, it's normally the second or third week we'll get a couple of storms. But we think we have a good 4 to 6 weeks of work out there. But, of course, it just depends on when the storm door opens.
Crews are chopping down hazardous trees, reestablishing route markers, removing floatable debris, and more. Roads are the park's next focus. Firefighters are currently monitoring the last 5% of the blaze still burning in the wilderness areas between Cherry Lake and Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. Full containment is expected by the end of October. So far, the fire has burned over 250,000 acres. The total fire effort has cost over $127 million. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Of course, the government shutdown has not only closed the parks, it's also put a dent in the pocketbooks of many tourism-related businesses. However, some businesses are actually seeing a boost from the shutdown, including our next guest, Max Stauffer, has run the Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Railroad in Fish Camp since 1981. He joins us on the telephone now. Max, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I understand you've actually seen business boom in the last week or so since the government shutdown. How's that happened for your business?
Well, it actually has. We have shown a quite dramatic increase because we're located only 4 miles south of the park entrance on Highway 41 at the south entrance. So we offer, you know, some recreational opportunities that obviously aren't available in the park anymore. We have a tourist train that runs through the Sierra National Forest, and we're still allowed to be open and in operation. So we offer, you know, options for tour groups and families that are up here that are struggling to find things to do.
So I heard you describe on your, or saw you describe on your Facebook page, you said it's actually been busier now in October than it was in July. What does that mean for your business and in those terms?
You know, it's really great for us, unfortunately, at the expense of a lot of other of our neighbors in the park and, you know, in federal lands. But we have, it's much better than it was in July. This hasn't been the best year for tourism in our area because of the fire that you just spoke about, and just the economy isn't bouncing back in the Central Valley as it has in other areas. So it's really nice for us to see the increase, especially in October.
Max Stauffer runs the Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Railroad. It's a historic 3-foot narrow gauge railway that operates just near Fish Camp at the southern gate to Yosemite. What are some of the stories you're hearing from folks who travel literally from around the world to see this wonder of the Golden State and have been essentially shut out? What are you hearing from them?
Well, there's a lot of anger out there. We had a tour group from Germany here just a couple of days ago, and the tour guide was telling us that they missed 5 national parks. They were scheduled to visit Zion, Bryce Canyon, the Grand Canyon, Sequoia, and Yosemite, and none of them were available for them. So they're pretty angry, and you know, it doesn't bode well for the tourism industry in America for foreign visitors, because you know, if they can't count on things being open that they want to see, it's going to hurt. And I expect our uptick is going to be short-lived because some people are making cancellations now for later based on things not happening in Washington, D.C. And our economy is quite fragile here, the tourism economy is, because of, you know, natural catastrophes that happen like the fire and then some man-made catastrophes like the government shutdown and issues that are going on in Yosemite with the Merced River plan and the reduction in some recreational opportunities that may be available for folks.
We certainly
it's a tough business to be in. Especially in this area.
Yeah, well, we certainly hope the situation is resolved, and I hope the area businesses in the mountain communities recover and get off to a great start for 2014. Max Stauffer, our guest on the phone, he's run the Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Historic Railway since 1981, just south of the Yosemite Gate on Highway 41, and he's actually seen business boom since the government shut down. Max, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition.
Well, I'm going to California, where they sleep out every night. Yeah. going to California where they sleep out every night.
Next year will mark the 75th anniversary of one of the most iconic novels of the 20th century, and one that tells the story of life in the Central Valley during the Great Depression, John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And while many of the Dust Bowl immigrants have since passed on, their stories remain. Joining us now on the telephone, we have Colleen Bailey, the executive director of the National Steinbeck Center. She is on the tour with 11 others who are taking part in this effort to commemorate the coming 75th anniversary of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. She joins us now from Amarillo, Texas. Colleen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You began on the 4th in Oklahoma and plan to wind up your trip in Arvin on the 14th. This is really exciting because it takes your trip right to our hometown here in Kern County, and we want to talk about that in a little bit, but tell us about how the origin of the idea for doing this caravan to celebrate the 75th anniversary of Steinbeck's famous novel, how did it come about?
Well, we have been celebrating Steinbeck with the Steinbeck Festival on an annual basis for over 30 years. And this last year, we were looking at doing something very special to celebrate the 75th anniversary. And we were planning and thought, what would Steinbeck do? And John Steinbeck was somebody who he traveled out to get a pulse of America. And from that stemmed some of his best creation, including The Grapes of Wrath. And so we thought we should do the same thing. So we decided we were going to go out on the road, take a pulse of America today, and see what we could do to compare it to Steinbeck's journey.
And you began in Oklahoma just a few days ago. Tell us about how this journey started, and you're retracing the original route along the old Route 66, or at least what remains of it today.
That's right. So we are retracing the journey that the Joad family took in the book The Grapes of Wrath. And we started in Salathaw, Oklahoma. We had a wonderful opportunity to meet with a group of people at the Stanley Tubbs Memorial Library, all who had lived through the Dust Bowl in Salathaw, Oklahoma. And so we had lunch with them. They had what they call a ranch lunch with cornbread and three kinds of beans. And then we collected oral histories with them, and we got to hear their memories of the Dust Bowl and their feelings about John Steinbeck and how accurate he was or was not in terms of giving an overview of what Salathaw people were like. And then we traveled on to Oklahoma City, and we visited with the Oklahoma History Center, did a panel discussion there to talk about the history of the Grapes of Wrath and the history of Oklahoma and the Dust Bowl, and then collected some oral histories there. We met there with a car club who had Model A's, and they followed our RV from Oklahoma City towards the border between Oklahoma and Amarillo, which is where we arrived yesterday, and we are here today in Amarillo, Texas. We've been at the Amarillo Museum of Art, where they're doing a wonderful exhibit of Dorothea Lange's photography. Dorothea Lange was also capturing the images of the people who were suffering from the Dust Bowl. So it's a great connection with our own project. And then today we're collecting oral histories in Salathaw.
Tell me a little more about that and talking to folks who lived through the Dust Bowl 75 years later now. Many of those who experienced this are unfortunately no longer with us. Those who are were young children. Are these memories, are you finding them still vivid of those days so many years ago?
You know, it's amazing how vivid some of these people's memories are. We met with a woman who is 102 years old. She has quite an incredible story to tell, but she can tell you in so much detail what it was like to live through those dust storms and you know, what it was like to see people leaving the community. And I think one of the things we're trying to get at with this journey is the idea that the American people are incredibly resilient. And what we want to discover is what it was that got them through in those days, got them through those really, really hard times. And these people were survivors and are survivors, and many of them have skills that I think we can learn from. They have great senses of humor. They know how to celebrate. They know how to take care of one another. And it's been quite inspirational.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Colleen Bailey. She's the executive director of the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas. She's talking to us today from Amarillo, Texas, however, because she's part of a group of 11 individuals who are making a trip from Oklahoma to Kern County to celebrate the 75th anniversary of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. You mentioned the fact, and you were talking to some people in Oklahoma who had varying perspectives on how Steinbeck described the people from that part of the country. When The Grapes of Wrath was first published, it was very controversial in a number of parts of the country. What feelings do you get about Steinbeck's legacy talking to some of those people today?
Well, there were a few people who mentioned that, especially in Salisaw, for example. Salisaw is really very, very close to the Arkansas border, and it's not at all what I kind of picture in John Steinbeck's work. You know, you picture Oklahoma being very flat and so on, and actually that part of Oklahoma is much further west. By the Arkansas border, you have more hills and lots more trees. It's quite lush, and people were saying, gosh, you know, that really didn't depict Salisaw exactly as you know, it is. And one person had a comment about the fact that, you know, there were only three tractors in Salisaw at the time that John Steinbeck wrote the book, and he makes it sound like there was an army of trucks coming in to take over the farms and, you know, move them from family-owned to corporate-owned farms. And actually, there were only three tractors at the time. So there, I think he did have, he took some creative license in writing the book, but that certainly was the truth as you go west, and we heard many stories in the west, as we've gone west, of people who said, no, that was exactly the way it was for us. Our family went through that, and that's exactly, Steinbeck depicted it exactly as I remember it. So, you know, varying sort of ideas of Steinbeck. But I'll tell you, today I think people are very, you know, while he might have been controversial at one time, I think they are very proud of how they're depicted now. You hear them talk about the fact that, you know, they were survivors, they were clever, they were innovative, they were hard workers. The people that we've met with are very, very proud of the work that they do. So that's been an interesting thing. I think history gives us a different perspective. And then for the younger generation that we're meeting with, you know, it's interesting to see the comparisons between what we've just been through with the Great Recession and some of what's happening in Washington now with the government closure and discussions of health care and immigration reform and all of these questions that are very similar to some of the things that they were talking about back in the 30s.
Yes, those questions that Steinbeck asked 75 years ago are still very relevant today. The faces may have changed, but the questions are still there. You're traveling as part of this group with, you've got some award-winning artists, historians, visual artists, filmmakers. You're planning on taking the information, as I understand it, that you're gathering along this caravan and then incorporating it into your upcoming exhibit, which will next year celebrate the 75th anniversary. Tell us about your vision for honoring this momentous anniversary.
Right. So we have three artists with us, Patricia Wakita, Octavio Solis, and PJ Palmer. And we have a film crew and four members of the staff. And actually, Penguin Books is also following us in their mobile bookstore. So we're quite a caravan. And we're collecting these oral histories as we go and collecting a lot of film footage of each of the places because, of course, John Steinbeck was very moved by the environment and landscape, the sense of place. And so we're capturing the sense of place as we go as well. And then each of the artists has been commissioned to create a new work based on the oral histories that they're collecting and their experience on the road. And in 2014, that content will be the what we will take back out into the country and share with people all over the country. So we're doing a three-day program at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. We'll be doing a program down at UC Bakersfield, a program up at Stanford University, And, of course, in May, we will be at the National Steinbeck Center for the Steinbeck Festival, the first weekend in May, to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Grapes of Wrath.
Well, it's very exciting. And, again, I should add there's a website, grapesofwrath75.org, that has a great number of photos and stories from the journey as it's taking place right now across the country. We're going to talk about the Arvin event in just a moment, but walk us through the rest of your journey before you get to Kern County. What are some of the other things that are coming up as you make your way out of the Texas Panhandle and into the beautiful country of New Mexico and then Arizona?
Well, we will be in Albuquerque. We're going to stay in a place called La Posada in Winslow, Arizona, which is a historical home. We drive to the Pioneer Museum, where we are going to collect oral histories. And then we go to Oatman, Arizona, and Barstow. And then we go to Bakersfield, and we have a big program at CSU Bakersfield on campus on the 13th. And our artists are going to actually do a program where they're going to show some of the film footage and talk about some of the oral histories they've collected. And they're actually going to do an oral history there in Bakersfield on the stage so that people can watch the process of taking an oral history. And then on the 14th, we will be at Weed Patch Camp in Arvin. This was a camp that was important to John Steinbeck. It's actually the model, as he saw it, of what the government should be doing to provide decent quality of life for the migrant workers. And it is still a working camp in Arvin. And we actually visited down there recently. And it's really a very nice place to live. And they still have some of the historic buildings right there that you can visit. And you can, if you'd like to go and see it on your own, you can actually make an appointment and people will come and meet with you and show you the historical buildings there.
Again, it's the tour that's taking place from Salisaw, Oklahoma to Arvin, California. It's underway right now. We're talking with Colleen Bailey. She's the executive director of the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas, and they are retracing the route of the Joad family, as told in John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. And the events wrap up again on the 13th and the 14th in Kern County, CSU Bakersfield on the 13th, and then at Weed Patch Camp in Arvin on the 14th. Colleen, if people want more information about the events in Kern County or the tour in general, what can they do and where can they go?
I would love for them to go to our website, which is www.steinbeck.org. On the website, you can access our blog, and all our artists are blogging every day. You can read about where we are in the journey. You can see images of the journey. We invite you from that page to participate actively in what we're doing. So we have a Facebook page that we're updating on a regular basis. You can go to our Twitter account if you'd like to do that. We're tweeting out questions and comments and images as we tour. And then Instagram, you can post photos and you can watch what we're posting along the route. We also have some drop-in programs, and if people have book clubs or if you're a teacher and you'd like to do something in your classroom to follow what we're doing and to celebrate with us, you can download those straight from our website.
Well, it sounds very exciting. We're looking forward to the events in Kern County and then, of course, the exhibit next year at the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas. Colleen Bailey, the executive director of the center, joins us today. Colleen, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter. We're at KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.